You're with us on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent, and we're talking about landmark federal legislation that's designed to take on high prescription drug costs. A vote could come soon in the House, but some progressive Democrats feel the bill called the Lower Drug Costs Now Act, that it could actually be expanded further and make more of an impact. Do you take prescription meds? Do you have private insurance or Medicare? Is it difficult for you to follow doctor's orders and fill your prescriptions due to the cost? How do you get by? We're at 800-642-1234. Representative Mark Pocan is a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District. That includes Madison, Beloit, and Dodgeville. Representative Pocan, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Oh, thank you, Kate. Glad to be here.
So before we get to prescription drug prices, quick hit here on impeachment inquiry. We heard Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell saying this week that a trial would start early next month and that he'd be totally surprised if there are 67 senators who vote to remove President Trump from office. So as you watch the whole markup process last night and today, finalizing the text leading into the full House vote, how are you feeling about how this inquiry has gone in your chamber?
Well, I think that, the sad part watching some of this is seeing one political party put their political party and the president's political fortunes ahead of the country. I mean, there's no question, based on everything the Intelligence Committee did, that the president reached out to a foreign leader, which is starting to look like a pattern after we saw Russia's involvement in the election, asked the leader of Ukraine to start investigation on a political opponent's family, withheld the military aid that we supported in Congress from that country, and refused to take any photos or have them come to the United States until they launched this investigation. It's not about a single phone call. That's what the president's trying to pretend. But after the investigation, including talking to political appointees by Donald Trump and career professionals in the State Department, this has been months of activity in order to try to have the president get this political gain. And that is a violation of his oath of office. It's a betrayal of the office of the presidency. And he puts both our and Ukraine's national security at risk when he does that. So at the end of the day, doing nothing would then say to any future president, Democrat or Republican, you are above the law. You can do anything you want. And that's just not acceptable. The Constitution put that into our hands. And that's why we're doing this process right now. And I hope that people will realize that the oath they swore was to the U.S. Constitution and not to any individual president.
When do you expect a full House vote?
Since they're voting today in Judiciary, I assume it'll be next week in the House, and that will give the Senate plenty of time to move forward in the new year.
Well, let's look here at prescription drug prices. The House is scheduled to vote on its bill to lower them this week. What would this bill change? What is it proposing?
So this is the most significant piece of legislation ever, I think, coming to the floor of Congress to address prescription drug prices. You know, if you go to my town halls now for 7 years, I think the number one issue that comes up is healthcare costs, and specifically around prescription drug costs. We pay 10 times more for insulin, for example, in the United States than you do in Canada or other countries, and that is ridiculous. It makes no sense to anyone. This bill gets at that. It takes the 250 most expensive drugs on a list. It orders the secretary to negotiate, and that's the key part, negotiate for lower drug prices with the prescription drug companies on those prices based on international pricing, because often people in other countries are paying significantly less than we are in the U.S., and it will seriously bring down the cost of drugs, estimated at over $1 trillion last time I saw, and bring about a half a trillion of savings to the government. And we're going to use that money then to expand Medicare to things like dental and vision and hearing and use it to enhance health care. But this is a very significant bill. It's never been something going on the floor where we're going to negotiate this strongly for prescription drug prices. And on top of some other things we did this year addressing the price of generics, we have a package of bills that can have a significant impact on everyone's life in Wisconsin.
We're talking with Mark Pocan, a Democratic U.S. representative from Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District. We are looking at legislation called the Lower Drug Costs Now Act that is pending in the House. You can join in with your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Congressman, you know, Pfizer said that this bill is dangerous. It holds drugs hostage. It overpromises. It puts innovation at risk. It gives government too much power. What are your responses to that?
Yeah, this bill is probably dangerous to CEOs' extra vacations every year. I don't know how much money they're making. But the reality is there's absolutely no excuse to make people in the United States pay 10, 20 times more for the identical drug than in another country. And when it comes to innovation, you know, really, this is something we should have looked at for a very long time, and I'm glad we finally are. Every drug approved by the FDA between 2010 and 2016, which is hundreds of drugs, every single drug had support from National Institutes of Health research money. That's our tax dollars. So we've already invested in every single drug approved by the FDA through 2016, and we're waiting for additional years, but I'm sure the pattern is going to continue. So for them to say that all this money goes into that, I think I saw an article recently where the amount of money spent on advertising is greater than the amount of money they spend on research and development. That just doesn't hold true. They have had an obscene amount of profits that should make even, you know, Al Capone should blush off of the business operation that they have been running, and it's time to put it in check. And you really can't argue the Hep C drug, for example, very effective in curing people from Hep C. $1,000 a pill, you have to take it for 90 days in a row. They didn't come up with the research. They bought the company that did. In the first year, they made up for their investment. The top five executives in the company, the first year, their bonuses was enough to cure everyone in the U.S., Canada, Great Britain, Australia, and one other country of Hep C. And yet they continue to do this to consumers in the United States, and they've licensed it for pennies on the dollar in other countries.
Okay,
that's just unacceptable.
So the bill sets, though, a minimum number of drugs that the government would have the ability to negotiate prices. Why is there a minimum number included in the bill and a maximum number?
Sure. Basically, because of the application of it, one, you have to have a minimum number to make sure a secretary, like in this administration, who may not want to actually lower drug prices, has to. So that's why there's a minimum number. But it's also based on the actual experience of Veterans Affairs. They negotiate about 50 drugs a year. That's what they have the capacity to do with staffing, and it's a long process. So we're being reasonable. We'd love to have more. We'd love to have 250 a year, and we'll submit another letter of 250, and we'll keep going. But reality, when you look at some other countries that have done this, it's generally somewhere between 0 and 100, and our experience in the United States has been about 50 drugs. So we're saying at minimum, they have to do at least 50, so you don't have a secretary who decides not to actually negotiate for pricing.
And you met with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi recently about changes to this bill. Do you see that the Progressive Caucus is on board here, or are there still changes you want to see made?
She made some significant changes. I mean, our bottom line goal was you had a good foundation of a bill. Why not make sure more people were included? So that's why we wanted to up that, you know, number, that minimum number to 50 drugs, so more people will have savings faster. And we also wanted to make sure that people who are in some certain kind of health care plans will also realize some of the savings. There were more things we would have liked to do, but we had some difficulty with every member of the caucus in supporting a bill that would have had the broader changes. But right now, that coupled with the other bills we've done on trying to get at generic drugs faster to the market, because that provides significant savings. I mean, we are about to, this year, do more than I think any year, have bills going to the Senate, hopefully to the White House, that will significantly lower the cost of prescription drugs. And honestly, it's just long, long overdue.
Talking about Democratic legislation to lower prescription drug prices with Congressman Mark Pocan, who stays with us. We'll be back in a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, it is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're talking about House Democrats' signature legislation to lower prescription drug costs. We have Congressman Mark Pocan on the line and the Lower Drug Costs Now Act. This is H.R. 3. It would allow the Secretary of Health and Human Services to negotiate lower prices for a minimum of 35 drugs per year, up to a maximum of 250 drugs per year. But drug companies like Pfizer are sounding alarm bells. They say this will hold drugs hostage, put innovation at risk. Your questions, your stories, welcome. 800-642-1234. Are you a physician? What have patients told you about being able to afford your meds? Do you think the system needs to change? Are you in pharmaceutical sales? How would you assess the market value of the drugs you talk to physicians about? Be part of the conversation right now. 800-642-1234. Representative Mark Pocan stays with us. Congressman, the Congressional Budget Office estimated that this bill would keep 8 new drugs from coming to the market over the next decade. Does that concern you at all about innovation and about new drugs actually getting to market?
Yeah, well, first of all, Kate, I have to correct you. You're saying the wrong number. It's a 50 drug minimum, and I think you're using the information before the amendments.
The amendments. Gotcha.
Yeah. So I just want to make sure, just so everyone knows, is that was 35 drugs in 10 years. It was 25 drugs in the first year. This way we've adjusted that. So I just wanted to make sure there's clarity on that. And we know, again, as I mentioned, we are taking some of that $500 billion of savings and putting that back into the NIH. And that's the money I mentioned that every single drug that's been approved in that period of time between 2010 and 2016 has benefited from. So we're taking more money and putting that into research that companies will benefit from. So at the end of the day, you're not going to have that problem. But also at the end of the day, if these high launch prices, especially on the new drugs, we're going after that also in the bill. And I think that's where we need to be as a country, because right now the United States has been picking up the payload for so much of these drugs rather than other countries. And that's just wrong. And it's really amounted to obscene profits. And now we can actually have a system that's fair to consumers and still extremely profitable to these companies.
So as it stands now, as you look at the legislation, do people on Medicare stand to benefit more from this than people on private insurance, or perhaps for people who are uninsured?
In fact, that's one of the things that this bill does better than some other legislation that I also supported. I wanted to have there was a bill that would have allowed Medicare to negotiate for prescription drugs. This bill goes further, so everyone benefits. It's not just people on Medicare, but many of those drugs are the most expensive, so they'll definitely benefit. But it's for all consumers to benefit. So really, it's going after the most expensive drugs that, by cost and by the volume of people who use. So we'll have the greatest amount of savings as early as possible, and then we'll keep hitting that many drugs a year until we have really significant savings for consumers.
So looking at the path forward here, this bill is expected to pass the House. It's not even up for consideration in the Senate. We've heard that President Trump has opposition to it. How will you move forward with this legislation?
Yeah, well, nothing would be considered in the Senate until we passed it. So that is pretty common practice. There is a different bill that Senate Republicans have that gets at prescription drug pricing. Generally, what will happen, Kate, is hopefully they'll pass their bill if they're serious about addressing this issue. We've now, after today, passed our bill. It will likely then go to a conference committee, and hopefully between the Senate Republican majority and the House Democratic majority, you could have one bill that goes to the president that would address prescription drug prices. But we wanted to put out, again, the strongest bill that does the best work in the shortest amount of time from the House of Representatives. And now it's really up to the Senate to do some action. But as you know, Kate, we've sent 400 bills to the Senate. 275 of them have been bipartisan bills. They're just not moving very fast. They're not getting a whole lot done. And we're hoping that in this area, we can convince them to get their job done.
What do you think of the Senate's version in this area?
Well, it's not nearly as comprehensive. And I think, you know, they're making sure that the CEOs of the pharmaceutical companies still make an awful lot of money. We're kind of putting consumers first, and we're saying, look, there's no reason why if you travel from Detroit, Michigan to Canada, just across the little waterway, and you can pay a tenth of the cost for insulin. Don't forget, insulin was created in the 20s, And the patent was sold by the three people who invented it for $1 each because they wanted everyone to have access to it, because you have to for your life if you're diabetic. And somehow the drug companies have figured out how to keep it under some sort of patent to here we are now in 2019. That's almost criminal. That's 100 years later. And they purposely sold it for $1 each because they wanted consumers to have access. We need to address those sort of issues. And if the Senate doesn't address them, they have to explain to their constituents why not. But we're able to say absolutely without question, we've actually said insulin has to be covered, and that'll happen in the very first year.
We're talking about the prescription drug prices bill under consideration in the House with Congressman Mark Pocan as our guide. Let's go to the phones now. Greg is joining us from West Bend. Hi, Greg.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I think for the countries that have less access to health care, it's only fair that they have cheaper prices. You know, I think the wealthier countries should pay their fair share to help offset those costs.
So you see, a funding formula where first world, more developed nations pay more for these particular prescription drugs, and countries that are not as well off pay less.
Right. You know, it's similar to the wealthy paying higher taxes to offset the lower income families.
Congressman Pocan, what do you make of that?
Well, that's not what's happening now. Canada, I would not refer to as a third world country, not a developing nation, and yet they're paying a tenth of the cost for insulin, a 20th of the cost on other drugs. That doesn't make sense. So, again, if all of Europe and other countries that are much like the United States are paying significantly less, we are the only ones right now paying these obscene amounts for the drugs. So, I appreciate what the caller's saying, and I think in general we should have more money going to healthcare, especially when we provide assistance as opposed to defense assistance in all these countries. In this particular case, right now we're footing the bill for everyone, and that doesn't make sense because our consumers at the end of the day are paying a whole lot more, and it stops a lot of people from getting access to drugs because they can't afford it. I mean, I can't tell you how many people have given us stories of cutting pills in half and everything else because of the cost. That's not right. And that means there's people in the United States who aren't wealthy who also need access to drugs, and we need to take care of that.
So when you look at market value for a drug, whether it's here in the United States or halfway around the world in another country, how do you negotiate with these pharmaceutical companies? Does our federal government have leverage?
Yeah. So first of all, there's an international rate that we're basing this on, so that there is a actual scientific standard we're doing it. And secondly, if they don't work with us on this, there's a very significant tax on the excess profits they have. So in other words, there's no financial incentive for them to continue to gouge people. So this is really bringing them to the table. They're still going to make a strong amount of money like they do in every other country. But we're not the only country paying for those excessive profits.
Americans spend more money on prescription meds than people in any other country in the world, as you've laid out here. What are you willing to compromise on to help deal with this issue and make tangible policy changes here in the U.S.?
Well, and I think that's what we'll see when the Senate passes whatever their version of the bill. We'll see what we have in common. We'll see what we don't have in common. But I think what we're trying to do with this bill is a negotiation model, and that's the key part. Kate, I've seen polling on this. 95% of the people, the pollster said, in 30 years of business, they've never seen the polling so high, thinks that we should be able to negotiate for drug prices, just like insurance companies do. When they have a group insurance plan, they're negotiating with the company for lower prices, yet we're not able to do that on behalf of all consumers. That's what we're trying to accomplish here, and that's why I think the idea of negotiation is a very popular idea, and it makes a lot of sense.
You know, this legislation, there seems to be a lot riding on it. It's been called landmark. It's been called Democrats' biggest piece of legislation. How much is riding on this moment?
Well, I think what's riding on it is I can just tell you from every time we see polling around the country on what issues are most important, healthcare is always one of the top issues, and the top issue within healthcare has been the cost of prescription drug prices. I can tell you the meetings I have in my office every single day, people who are on drugs that are costing $50,000 or $100,000 a year just to stay alive. This is what people think about every day at their kitchen table. Can they get by? And it's such an important issue. So I think the reason it's so important is because it's an issue that has not been addressed as it should have for a very long time. Consumers are feeling it, and we're hearing it from our constituents.
And it sounds like you want to bring this back to your district and say, hey, listen, I listen to you, and here's what's going to happen.
Well, and even more importantly, I want people to, you know, be reaching out to all their elected officials and saying it's far too long that we haven't done this. Let's get to it, because that's what we need, is that extra public pressure so that people like Ron Johnson and Tammy Baldwin are hearing it in the Senate so they can have the strongest bill as well. And if you have two strong bills come out at the end of the day, hopefully we'll have a strong compromise bill. So I think, you know, people reaching out to their elected officials is really key on this.
Congressman, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much, Kate. Appreciate it.
Mark Pocan is a Democratic U.S. representative from Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District, includes Madison, Beloit, and Dodgeville. Coming up, the Washington Post this week published extensive analysis on the war in Afghanistan. It's based on documents containing interviews with hundreds of people involved in the war. Have you served in Afghanistan? What do you think of our foreign policy? Should we have troops there? We're at 800-642-1234. Back after this news update with takeaways on the Afghanistan papers here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And a note about our programming here, the House Judiciary Committee will continue considering two articles of impeachment against President Trump. You can hear live coverage starting at 8. That's live coverage of the House Judiciary Committee sessions starting in about 25 minutes from now on WPR and online at WPR.org. Right now, we're looking at what the Washington Post calls the Afghanistan papers. Earlier this week, the Post published thousands of pages about the long-running military campaign in Afghanistan. It's gone on 18 years. And so the documents together show a systemic failure in the U.S. effort to rebuild Afghanistan after claiming victory over the Taliban and al-Qaeda in early 2002. So how do you feel about these newly published documents on the war? What do you think of U.S. foreign policy in this part of the world? Should U.S. troops be in Afghanistan today? Join in any point, 800-642-1234. Nita Crawford is a political science professor and department chair at Boston University. She studies the costs and consequences of war. As co-director of the Costs of War Project, it is based at Brown University and Boston University, and it's made up of about 50 scholars. Nita, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you.
So this is thousands of pages on a single war this week. Perhaps for many Americans, information overload a bit. What should we be thinking today about war at this moment in time?
I think that what the Post's research has shown is that decision makers in the White House, the Pentagon, the State Department knew that they were running into difficulty in Afghanistan and the war was not winnable quite early on. And their optimism or hope or fear of electoral consequences kept them from telling the American people what they were seeing on the ground, which was they couldn't win the war militarily.
The papers also point to something like positivity bias, whereas these conversations going on inside the circles of government are different than the outward-facing conversation to the American public at large that this war is on track as we know it. What can you say there in terms of political science and what you see?
Well, if you're thinking about political psychology, there are a number of cognitive biases that came into effect. They ignored disconfirming information for the most part until it became unignorable. There's also a confirmation bias. Anytime there was anything positive, the decision maker sort of latched on to that and trumpeted that, even when they had other evidence that said that they're losing territory, for example, or that the number of al-Qaeda and Taliban were growing rather than diminishing. So it's actually a train of cognitive and affective effects that began right on 9/11 and have continued to the present, actually.
President Trump's former national security advisor, Michael Flynn, was director of intelligence for the International Security Assistance Force in Afghanistan from 2009 to 2010. And so he said in this one document, there is a machinery that is behind what we do and it keeps us participating in the conflict because it generates wealth. What is the economy of war?
I think of it as actually a political economy. On the one hand, there are companies that benefit from selling weapons. There are companies, private contractors that benefit from taking over the functions of the U.S. military and performing them overseas, you know, providing security and training and so on. But the real problem is the political economy. That is the way that members of Congress believe two things. One is that they must support the troops unequivocally and in a full-throated manner and can't question conflicts, can't question war, must salute. And the other part is they're worried that if they say that we shouldn't have high military spending, the defense contractors in their districts will not have jobs, that people will reject reductions in military spending because they're concerned about jobs. Now, a couple of those things are wrong. For one, military spending doesn't produce as many jobs in many cases as other sectors, for instance, infrastructure or education or healthcare. But the other thing is protecting the troops means not sending them out into harm's way if it's not necessary or useful or is in fact counterproductive.
What by the numbers and the cost of war project has looked deeply into the numbers. Where do we stand in the number of troops who have died in Afghanistan over these 18 years?
Well, the U.S. military has lost about 2,300 soldiers, sailors. And then there's other DOD civilians, a few of those people. Now, think about this. The number of contractors, U.S. contractors who've died, is greater than the number of U.S. troops who've been killed. In addition, about 43,000 Afghan civilians have lost their lives directly due to violence, the bombs and bullets and fires that are caused by war. About 42,000, about approximately the same number of opposition fighters have been killed, Al-Qaeda, Taliban, Haqqani Network, and so on. And hundreds of humanitarian workers have lost their lives. The war has also spilled into Pakistan, where about 24,000 civilians have lost their lives on the border and in related conflicts as the United States chased the Taliban and Al-Qaeda into Afghanistan. We also began to support the Pakistan. We also began to support the Pakistani government, sending them weapons, equipment, and providing training so that they could attack those militants. And when we did so, the Pakistani military managed to kill, in some cases, some years, more civilians than they did militants.
We're talking with Nita Crawford. She's a political science professor at Boston University, studying the costs and consequences of war as co-director of the Costs of War Project. You can join in. What do you think of U.S. foreign policy in this part of the world? Should U.S. troops be in Afghanistan today? Do you remember when we first went to war with Afghanistan? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Nita, for people who haven't seen these documents yet, these thousands of pages yet, what are some of the interviews that stick out to you? And where did these documents come from? What did the Washington Post unearth here?
Well, they're mostly based on the work of the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction. They had a series of papers called Lessons Learned. And they also did this in Iraq, where what they were trying to do was understand what the effectiveness of U.S. Action was and Allied action, as well as the training of Afghan military and police, and then looking at the effectiveness and the costs and the benefits of aid to Afghanistan and Afghanistan reconstruction. So the focus there was on learning lessons. And those interviews were actually quite recent. In the last few years, they did not interview people from the beginning of the conflict, which of course is October 2001. And what stands out to me is the at least at this point, you know, post 2011, the officials like Douglas Lute and Michael Flynn are clear that the war is not going well. And yet, a couple of things are happening in public at the same time. There's reluctance to talk about the number of Afghan military and police who are there, yet we want to keep funding them, that we've hoped have been recruited and trained. And there's eventually an erasure or a denial or a classification of the ways that those people are dying. In fact, more Afghan military and police have been dying in recent years than militants. They've been killed by the militants. So there's been disappearing data. The reporting on civilian casualties. Now, at various points in the war, the United States has emphasized that they wanted to be precise and protect civilians. And the focus on protecting civilians has waxed and waned. And what we see now is an increasing toll on civilians as the war has heated up in the last few years. But there's during this period that they're talking about, they're always saying that they regret the tragic loss of life and these are unintended consequences. Yet they're not really grappling with the fact that when they killed civilians, the number of militants was actually boosted and militant attacks actually grew because people don't like it when their brothers, sisters, mothers, fathers are killed in airstrikes and so on. So there's this in the documents, but also if you compare the documents to what's actually happening in the world at the same time as the reflections were being made to the SIGAR, you see that there's a dissonance, sort of a lack of grappling with the counterproductive nature of the use of military force in this place.
We're talking about the Afghanistan Papers and the Washington Post investigation published this week with Nita Crawford. She's a political science professor, department chair at Boston University. She co-directs the Costs of War Project. How do you feel about the longest war? Do you trust the government when it comes to foreign policy in Afghanistan and U.S. troops' mission there? Should the U.S. stay in Afghanistan or pull out of the country? Join in with your questions, your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back with political scientist Nita Crawford in just a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Washington Post calls it a secret history of the U.S. war in Afghanistan. It's 2,000 pages of interviews with senior U.S. officials, others directly involved in the conflict. The documents contain candid revelations about how U.S. politicians, how generals misled on the status of the war that's gone on 18 years. How do you feel about how the U.S. has approached its mission in Afghanistan? President Trump paid an unexpected visit last month, said he's reopened talks with the Taliban. How do you feel about U.S. foreign policy in light of the new documents and in light of our actions today? Join in 800-642-1234. Boston University political scientist Nita Crawford is co-director of the Costs of War Project, and she stays with us. Let's go to the phones now. Emil is joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Emil.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Two questions for your guest. The first question sort of arises, I was just in Paris recently, and I overheard a gentleman talking, and you know, he said, you know, for a country, referring to America, that seems to do a whole lot of global policy as it has as a hegemon, its people tend to not know a whole lot about the world and international affairs. So as it relates to my question, to guess, how much do you think our perceived lack, or maybe the reality of our lack of international affairs literacy, how much does that affect, you know, what politicians think they can get away with? And as it relates to the second question, how much of the war right now is more about the war itself and more of a civilization, a clash of civilizations? Thank you.
Emil, thank you for that two-part question. Nita, the first part being that Americans really don't understand the nuances of foreign policy in other countries, specifically here in the area of Afghanistan.
Well, there's a lot to understand. I don't blame Americans for not being able to keep track of what's going on. But I think the key thing here is historical perspective. When the United States went to war in Afghanistan in 2001 and then in 2003 in Iraq, we were told that those conflicts would be quick, that they were more effective than the alternatives like sanctions or law enforcement. We were assured that these wars would be cheap, or in the case of Iraq, pay for itself, you know, that they'd be controllable, you know, and precise, few civilians would die. There'd be, you know, little permanent consequences for the budget and so on. In all of those cases and all of those promises, it's not been the case, right? And what we see is something that's quite familiar. We went to war in 1812 and in the Civil War and in the Philippines and World War One and Korea and Vietnam with the same kinds of promises that war be quick, effective, cheap, controllable, precise, and not have larger economic consequences. So if we're given better history, I think that we could see with some sort of more critical perspective the promises that are made at the beginning of the war, and we wouldn't be so surprised when things go south. And then in terms of Congress and the members' responsibility there, the members in 2001, save one person, voted yes for the authorization for the use of military force. And the person with courage, Barbara Lee from California.
Mm-hmm.
Said no. And I think that that's telling. She, at that moment of fear and anger, said, war's not the answer. She stood by herself. The American people in the 2008, 2009 began to be less supportive of these wars, but Congress has not had the courage to say, we must do something different. So I think we have to push Congress. Congress, as Ed Markey, the senator here from Massachusetts, says, is a stimulus response institution. They would respond to the American people saying, enough, or let's at least be careful and have hearings on a regular basis about the progress here.
Your research has determined that war spending in Afghanistan has totaled nearly $2 trillion since 2001. Do you find...
Let me just correct you on
sure.
that. Okay, so the spending for war comes in different categories. For
uh-huh.
instance, there's Department of Defense direct war spending. That's overseas contingency operations spending or emergency funding. That's about $1 trillion, a little under $1 trillion. And then there's State Department spending on Afghanistan. And that's total around $1 trillion. There's very little State Department money, actually, comparatively. It's about $100 billion. So,
how easy is it to trace the dollars when, as you mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. data goes missing?
Well, there's a couple of things that have been going on with the data on military spending. It's always reported in current dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a request by the Department of Defense. Oftentimes, the request for emergency or overseas contingency operation spending is added to by Congress, who wants to look strong on defense. And sometimes the reporting and the categorization is fuzzy. For instance, in the last 2 years, the Trump administration has added a category saying that the overseas contingency operation money should go to the base budget. So they've added a new way of accounting. So it's sometimes difficult. But essentially, what I'm using is the request by the Department of Defense and congressional appropriations to get the money spent on the war in Afghanistan in current dollars, and the same with the State Department. But the problem here is that because we've been at war so long, it's not just the spending for the emergency appropriations. The base military budget, that is the bulk of military spending that's supposedly non-war, has been inflated due to the fact that military pay has had to go up to keep people going back 2, 3, 4 times and reenlisting. They get reenlistment bonuses as well.
Multiple tours. Uh-huh.
Yes. And then there's the fact that their healthcare expenses have grown because these conflicts are very difficult physically, especially when you're returning as many times as these soldiers have. And it's costing a lot of money to keep them healthy. That's their TRICARE medical expenses. And then in addition, there's replacement and upgrading of equipment. So the base military budget has increased. So that's part of the cost that we're tracking with the cost of war. Then there's Homeland Security spending and the spending on veterans. So there have been about 4 million people from the United States who've served in Afghanistan, Iraq, and the other places that were fighting in the war on terror, the 80 or so other countries that were engaged in. And those 4 million veterans will need health care now and over the next 30 years until they age out into other forms of assistance for medical care. So we're including the cost of that.
Pause right here and bring in David in Milwaukee with thoughts. David, hi.
Hey, guys. Enjoying the conversation. I was a Iraqi veteran, 2004-2005 OIF-2 Bravo Marine. My comment is I like your approach. I like the just the historical approach. My opinion, I'm a bit of a Pat Buchanan type of guy, which I guess makes me a bit of a Trump guy. I think we went wrong you mentioned it, the war in the Philippines. And I think our willingness to get involved in anything and everything over the last 100+ years has just been, it's brought a lot of benefits. I'm not discounting that. But violence begets violence, and I'm not a pacifist by any stretch.
And David, I'm so sorry. We are short on time. Anita, I want to let you have a few seconds here. As David mentioned there, violence begets violence.
It also begets despair. And one of the most important things that we don't hear about, and it's not even in the Afghanistan papers, is the fact that active duty soldiers who we were just talking about and veterans are killing themselves at high rates. More veterans and more active duty soldiers died in the United States of suicide or abroad of suicide than have died in these wars in the last few years.
Nita Crawford, thank you so much. Nita Crawford is a professor, chair of Department of Political Science at Boston University, co-director of the Costs of War study based at Brown University and Boston University. I'm Kate Archer Kent. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.